Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, I'm Amy, and I work at Lowe's. Join us for the Lowe's floor event and find tons of great options for under $1 per square foot, like Marfil ceramic tile for only 88 cents per square foot, or in-stock Stainmaster carpet starting at only 98 cents per square foot. Also, choose 18-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more when you use your Lowe's consumer credit card. Lowe's, let's build something together. Flooring offer valid through 8/1/11 while supplies last. Special financing offer valid through 7/25/11 and cannot be combined with 5% off everyday credit offer. See store for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman. And this is Walls in Our Minds. And boy, are we excited tonight. Don't have our guest online yet, I don't believe, but Dr. Edwin Vieira is going to be with us here shortly. And Red, how are you doing?
I'm here. I'm present and accounted for.
Well, while we're waiting for Dr. Vieira to join us, Red, would you open us in a prayer?
I can do that. Heavenly Father, we approach your throne tonight with great thanksgiving. Thanksgiving because we know that you have people out here in our world today that have truth. And we know that we have a real shortage of truth in our world today. And we have always been trying to find the truth and expound on the truth here in this program. And we just pray, dear Lord, that you would help us tonight, that we might be able to communicate with thousands of our countrymen, and that we might be able to put the truth out there where people can access it and check it out and accept it. If they find that what we have is true, they need to accept it. Our country is in trouble, and everyone seems to know it in this country at this point in time. And we need solutions, and we need your help, because we have allowed all of these terrible things to happen to our country, the debt, the abortion issue, and all of these other things, and we have allowed it to happen. We ask for your forgiveness for our failure to do as we should have done and been more in touch with you. And now, dear Lord, we ask for your forgiveness and help us to gain some truth here tonight in this program. We thank you for allowing us this opportunity. We ask this now in thy precious and thy holy name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Red. Really appreciate that. Let's see. I was just checking to see if Dr. Vieira is on with us. Kate, if you would just let me know when Edwin arrives, I would appreciate that. And
I'm on.
Red, you were telling me a little story today that I don't know if you recall what you were talking about. I believe Dr. Vieira is on live, 540 area code. That would be Dr. Vieira. I'd like to introduce everyone to our very special guest tonight, Dr. Edwin Vieira.
My pleasure to be with you.
Well, Edwin, it's been a while since you've been on with Red and I, and I tell you, I've been really, really excited to have you on with us, and I know Red has too, and you guys might just say hello to each other before we get into the discussion.
Hello, Red. How are you doing?
Well, I'm getting by, and it's just a real thrill for me to be a part of this tonight because You have a lot of answers that the American people need to hear about, solutions for our problems. And, of course, the big thing at this point is just defining our problems so that we've got a lot of people that know we're in trouble, but they don't know, they don't really know what all the problems are, and they need to have these problems defined for them so that they can make the proper corrections.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and also they need to focus on those problems that are of most immediate consequence. Quite a lot of what you see going on out there, the ferment in the political arena, is what they call in the stock market churning. I mean, a lot goes on, a lot of activity, but not much gets done because people aren't focusing on the things that should be the priorities. How is it, I would also ask the question, that every time we get together, the situation in the country is worse? Have you noticed that?
I have noticed.
It seems to heal people's ears, though, Edmund. I mean, Red's been saying this for a while. You know, for 30 years or so, he was preaching to them, and nobody was listening. And now all of a sudden, they seem to be willing to listen.
Yeah, I know. I've been fooling around with these monetary questions since the early 1970s. And I wouldn't go so far as say preaching, but just pointing out to people that this system had inherent flaws in it and it was going to fail in a certain way. And no one tended to believe that because things seemed to be going along fairly well, and then there'd be a little glitch in the system, and they'd pay attention for a little while and then go back to sleep. Well, now it's gotten to the point where I don't think anybody can be asleep any longer. The difficulty is we're also running out of time in which to try and correct the situation. If we had been active in performing certain steps in the area of monetary reform 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have these problems today. And unfortunately, these systems have a life of their own, and it's gotten to the stage now where most of the people I talk to, talking about the possibility of a hyperinflationary event, collapse of the paper currency system, if you will, along the, say, the South American lines, Argentinian line, or Brazil, one of those countries. I haven't talked to anyone who thinks, well, we have as much as 10 years. It's always much less than that. Some people are down to 2 years. And running out of time, the grave difficulty is that the less time you have, the more likely you may make some imprudent decision simply because you have to do what you have to do in a very short period. And I don't think that's necessarily going to help us. So we're put in a very difficult position. Of course, people on the other side are in a very difficult position, too. As I like to say, they're riding a tiger. They don't really know what they're doing, and they can't get off that tiger for all sorts of reasons. The main one, I think, is that they would lose, of course, their social and political and economic positions of power, and they don't want to do that under any circumstances. But even in terms of looking at it from a, kind of an instrumental point of view, I don't think that they understand how they can get control of this system anymore. They're just attempting to keep that Ponzi pyramid blown up for as long as possible and maybe hope something comes along in the sense of one of these global currency initiatives that people are proposing from the IMF or something to bail them out in a sense of the problem in which they've put themselves. So in one sense, this is a very good opportunity for us. It's the first time in certainly in all the years that I've been working on this subject that we really have had a wake-up call that people have paid attention to. I mean, the phone's ringing, and you know they're looking, getting ready to pick it up. And that's good. But then on the other side, we have the limited amount of time left. And thirdly, we have the problem that the people who are in charge of the monetary system probably don't know what they're doing, and they could make a blunder. And that blunder could precipitate a major collapse in a very short period of time. So a lot of these different flows, if you will, historical and otherwise, are now converging, and it's really very difficult to predict what's going to happen, other than to say we have to follow a course that's designed to get what we want, and the devil take the hindmost, in a sense, if you know what I mean. I mean, we can't worry about Washington, D.C. We can't worry about what the media say. We can't worry about what the beautiful people are going to say about us. We have to worry about putting in a reform mechanism that is going to give us, number one, some economic stability, and number two, the thing that I'm most worried about is the how shall I put it, the removal of the possibility that we're going to end up with some kind of a police state mechanism imposed on the whole country out of Washington, D.C., if we have a major economic breakdown, because that's the way they'll respond to it. And you can see that they've already set up the mechanisms for that, the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA, and then stretching down to your local and state police departments with these, what do they call them, not crisis centers, fusion centers, right? People have probably read about those. And then various reports that are coming out about the desire of Homeland Security people in Janet Napolitano's office to interface with the regular armed forces so that you'd have National Guard troops or regular Army troops participating in these essentially local and state police operations. And the whole thing has the smell of South America, you know, in the era of the Perones and the other military juntas. All of the elements are there. Irresponsible civilian politicians, massive governmental debt, special interest groups dominating the political process, at least at the national level, an unstable monetary system, and lurking in the background the possibility of military intervention to deal with social and economic breakdown. Very bad scenario.
Well, Dr. Bureau, I was talking, I believe it was Red earlier today mentioned to me something about that right before the years right before the Declaration of Independence, that there seemed to be a rising of those good people, you know, the better minds, the ones that are, they started to rise up and start filling those leadership roles and coming to the forefront. And do you see that happening now or not?
Well, certainly not to the degree that it occurred then. I mean, you look at the constellation of famous names just out of places like Virginia, where I'm located right now, right? The Patrick Henrys, Jeffersons, Madisons, Peyton Randolph. You run down these, like George Washington, right? You run down these lists of famous names just from that one state. It's pretty hard to come up with a list even that long from any one of the states in this country. I mean, you really have to look long and hard to find people of that caliber. So I don't know. There's our problem. That they are there are probably some, maybe many, lurking out there in the woodwork, and they have yet to surface. So that's a worrisome thing to me there. And remember, those people were active, well, from the time of the Stamp Act crisis, which was back in the 1760s. So middle 1760s, 1770s, you're talking about 10 or 12 years. Things moved a lot slower in that era.
Because we sure need good people to rise to the top to lead. We need leadership that's going to be articulate and responsible. And it seems like that void is being filled by people who have an esoteric and an exoteric agenda, and there's a lot, so much deception out there. It's very difficult to build a level of trust with somebody because they just seem to always have these other agendas going on. And it's just a time when we need people like the Red Beckmans and the Dr. Vieiras to take the forefront in this time. And I've watched you guys and I've listened to you both. And the thing that I have appreciated about you is that you've stayed on point. You've been clear about what your messages are. You've been articulate, but you've also related it in a way that people can understand it. And you've talked about things that we can actually do, something that's actually going to accomplish something. So many people go out there and they spout off, and they talk about things that really are not going to make a difference, things that we really don't have that much control over. You know, people have gotten so tied up in the 14th Amendment, for example, or mm-hmm. or trying to fight this battle in court. And maybe that's a good place for you to start out tonight, Edwin, is to talk about tell us a little bit about why you have focused on the things that you focused on, because I know that there's things you've deliberately avoided. And I think that's a good place for us to start the groundwork tonight, is to talk about why you focused on the things you focused on.
Well, if you look at the two that I've been most active in promoting in the last few years, probably since around 2005 when I started putting stuff up on the internet. There's been monetary reform and then more recently revitalization of the militia. Going back to the basic principles that the two great powers of any government are the power of the purse and the power of the sword, and then ultimately the most important of those two is the power of the sword, because that generally tends to determine who has the power of the purse. And looking at it practically speaking, if you don't have a functioning economy, you're not going to maintain the security of any kind of governmental or political system, let alone a free society. And you can't maintain a functioning society, economic functioning society, in a crisis situation unless the people have control of ultimately the police power, if you will, because you're going to have social dislocations, economic dislocations, political dislocations. So the people have to have those two powers of government firmly in their hands in order to maintain what the Constitution calls in the Second Amendment a free state or an Article IV Republican form of government. And we've been seeing the second of those powers, the power of the sword, gravitating to Washington and now being kind of sucked into this black hole of the Department of Homeland Security. And that thing has taken on a life of its own along the lines of something that looks like it comes out in 1953 Czechoslovakia, if you know what I mean, Stalinist Czechoslovakia, and has been developing along those lines systematically. So that's not accidental that that's happened. And on the other side, we have this totally unstable monetary and banking system. And given that this is a free market economy based upon a rational price structure, if your monetary system, which is the method by which prices are determined or at least prices are communicated, if that breaks down, then everything else goes with it for some length of time until you restabilize some kind of monetary unit. So without those two things in our hands, as opposed to the hands of the people who are now controlling them, we're in very serious trouble. Which of the two is the more immediately important? Probably, I think, the militia one, because if the banks break down, which we can't necessarily control at this stage, and I don't think the people in Washington or in New York can control that either. I think they're worried about that. But if that comes down, then we're left with economic, social, and political chaos, and at that stage, it's really a police problem more than an economic problem. And that's the real worry to me, because if you have that kind of a breakdown, they set up some kind of national police state run out of the Department of Homeland Security, or even worse, you have some kind of paramilitary takeover, then the possibility of restoring a free society economically or otherwise in the near future is just essentially wiped out. That's been the history of most every other country that's gone down that path. So I've been interested in those two areas now. If you look at the monetary side of this problem, that cannot be solved through the judiciary. I will say it categorically, it is impossible to do that through the judiciary for a number of reasons. First, the kinds of cases that come up are adventitious. It depends who the litigants are. It depends what court you're in, how far you get up the chain. So there's no way really to force a decision, even if you can set up on paper some kind of perfect case. Secondly, from an institutional point of view, the courts are least capable part of the government for dealing with this, because a judge can be presented with some case and the issue is, well, some part of the Federal Reserve System or the whole system is unconstitutional or it's illegal in some other way, and he can make that kind of a declaration. Yes, on this basis, Federal Reserve System is unconstitutional, gives an injunction, declaratory judgment, whatever. What then happens? Well, there would be chaos in the markets, right? Because now a major part of the economic mechanism has been struck down legally. Can the judge deal with that? Of course he can't. Why? He's knocked out a part of the Federal Reserve System or the banking system, whatever. He knocked some part of those statutes out. But he can't tell Congress what statute to pass in the place of the thing he's declared invalid, and he certainly can't enact such a statute. So his role will be entirely destructive, not constructive. And it will also come very quickly, and it will throw, as I say, a monkey wrench into the gears. So attempting to take this thing up through the judicial system is really playing with dynamite, because if by some happenstance some judge flapdoodle were to declare the Federal Reserve System unconstitutional tomorrow, we would be in very, very deep trouble as a practical matter. It has to be done through some kind of legislative action, because you have to deal with the whole picture and the ability to not only to pass new legislation, but perhaps to repeal old legislation and amend whatever's in there. Can it be done at the congressional level? Answer is no. Practical matter, who controls Congress? Well, the banks and the New York brokerage houses control Congress. At least on this issue they do. And the last thing they're going to give us is the kind of monetary reform that we want. I would love to see Ron Paul go after them in his committee and start asking some very penetrating questions about the status of the gold stock of the United States. How much gold is there? How much is good delivery gold? How much might be encumbered in some way because of swaps or some of these other deals that we've heard about in terms of manipulating the gold market? He certainly should look into that. But legislation is not going to come out of this Congress to change the Federal Reserve fundamentally, mainly because who's the president? Right? You have the veto man over there, and you don't have a veto-proof Congress, even if you could assume that they would follow a Ron Paul lead in terms of somehow, let's call it reforming the Federal Reserve System. So where do we have to look? And the answer is it has to be the state level. And the state level at the level of the state government as opposed to the level of the county or town governments, because in most states, counties and towns are mere creatures of the state. They really don't have any independence. And usually their ability to pass legislation is relatively circumscribed, so they can't go too far on a limb with, say, monetary reform. And even if you had monetary reform in one county, well, I don't know what real effect that would have in terms of the whole state or the whole country. But if you could turn a particular state around and you could cause a state government to adopt for itself and then to make available the ability to adopt within its private economy an alternative currency, now all of a sudden you've changed the game, because, number one, every state has a state government. Has a fairly large economic impact. We're not talking about just individuals here. And secondly, that particular state's action will be an example to other states, showing people this can be done. And then you will have the tremendous power of the free market competition that will come in between whatever the alternative currency is and Federal Reserve notes. And I'm pretty confident which direction that competition between currencies will move the country. So if it can be done there, at that one state level, it will have a life of its own. Question is, how do you do that? And the answer, in my mind, is, well, first, you know, practically, can you draft some kind of a statute? Can somebody draft that statute that will work? And the answer is yes, that can be done. And do the states have the authority to enact that? And the answer is yes. In fact, the Supreme Court ruled twice specifically on that issue back in the late 1800s. And said that a state has the authority as a quasi-sovereign, at least, retained sovereignty, to adopt whatever currency it wants, even if Congress has designated some other currency as a legal tender. The state doesn't have to pay attention to that. It can adopt whatever currency it wants to use. So you have legal authority. You have certainly political authority in the sense of a legislature can pass that kind of a statute. You can draft that kind of a statute. Why isn't it going to be done? Well, you have to educate some state legislators. That's number one. And then you have to have a significant amount of grassroots influence or pressure, lobbying pressure, if you will, because other legislators will have to realize that there's support behind this at the constituent level, if you will, to push it through. And the experience I've had in New Hampshire, for instance, several years ago, some people up there were promoting a bill that I had drafted for them for an alternative currency. That didn't get out of committee because the fellow who was in charge of the committee was very hostile to it. And there was no grassroots support for that particular bill, so he could afford just to use parliamentary procedure and stifle any kind of hearings, and so they had no witnesses, no nothing. It went nowhere. In Montana, a couple of years later, they picked up that New Hampshire bill and modified it to fit Montana's circumstances. It went into a committee up there. At that point, we, in fact, had some hearings, and I testified, and Larry Parks, James Turk. So we gave him a pretty good presentation, I think, on the value of that legislation. But unfortunately, at that particular time, Montana's legislature, at least the House, was split exactly 50-50, Republican-Democrat. And the committee voted 9-9, and with a split vote like that, that particular bill did not get out of committee to go to the full House in the Montana legislature. And there was an example. First one was an example of one individual in a committee. Second was an example of this partisan bickering. And the point I tried to make to them in the little presentation that I gave was this is not a partisan issue. This has nothing to do with Republicans versus Democrats. Is the country going to be saved or is it going to collapse economically? Which is it? And I can't imagine that some Democrat is going to say, well, I want that to happen because of, you know, the Republicans are in office or vice versa. It had nothing to do with it. But there were some people who were more interested in voting on a partisan basis than they were in looking at the merits and the necessity for the legislation. So what I hope is happening now is that people are starting to realize that party labels have nothing to do with this. You're not going to solve this problem because you get a Republican bill or a Democratic bill in there. You're going to solve the problem because you get the right piece of legislation if you get it in time. And that's what I keep trying to push on them. I think what has to be done is a practical matter. And we tried this in New Hampshire. Same fellow actually stifled it in New Hampshire. And it probably can be done in a number of other states. But here in Virginia, I think we have a procedure for it. Most legislatures have some kind of committee or procedure whereby one house or both can adopt a resolution usually to set up something like an advisory commission. They'll give it some name along that line. And the one they had in New Hampshire and the ones they do here in Virginia, one of those commissions is set up with so many members from the House, so many members from the Senate, and a couple of representatives or so from the executive branch. And then they're given a budget and a certain amount of time and an issue to study, and they call in witnesses and take testimony and get evidence and so forth. And then they'll write some kind of a report recommending action in one way or another and submit that back to the legislature. Usually a bill will be drafted if it's appropriate to do it. That would be a very useful step at this stage because we have to educate legislators. We have a very big job to educate legislators. And that needs to be done not just in blogs or internet columns or letters to the editor or what have you. It has to be done in some kind of official forum so they're going to pay attention to it, and maybe the media are going to pay some, local media that is, are going to pay some attention to it. And that means hearings, testimony, evidence presented in some kind of a formal legislative session. So I think at this stage, right now, the first thing to do is that sensitization, if you will, of the legislators at the state level to the need to do this. And that will happen once these witnesses are put on. I will guarantee you, if I get that platform, somebody sets up one of these commissions and calls me to bring in witnesses, I will bring in witnesses that will scare the socks off them as to where we are and what the dangers are and what we need to do. And I give you this example, really simple-minded, but here it is. If you go to I think it's probably still on the internet, 2007 Journal of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, their economic journal. There's an article in there by a man named Lawrence Kotlikoff, K-O-T-L-I-K-O-F-F, called "Is the United States Bankrupt?" And you go and look that up on the internet, you find that right away. 2007. This paper has a lot of econometric formulas in it. He comes out with a figure for what he calls the fiscal gap, which is the revenues versus expenditures, and it means that the anticipated expenditures are greater than the revenues. Fiscal gap for the government in Washington, D.C. at that time was calculated to be $65.9 trillion. And in that paper, Kotlikoff, he's a professor of economics at Boston University, he said, well, it's unpayable. No way that we can deal with this. And he gives a plan. He says, well, you cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all these cuts in the budget, and then put on a 33% national sales tax. you might begin to get this problem under control. You wouldn't solve it, but you might begin to get it under control. But in that paper, he says, well, that's very unrealistic politically. So what does he think is going to happen? There's about half of a page of the paper in the middle of the paper. He's got this kind of hidden. He says, oh, well, the Treasury will come to the banks and tell the banks they have to buy Treasury paper, and we're going to fight for inflation. Easy solution, South American solution. That's what Mr. Bernanke did the other day, right? $600 billion more. He's going to buy Treasury paper. All right? Kotlikoff and the IMF came up with some revised figures not too long ago. It's probably now a month. And you go look up Professor Kotlikoff's website, you can find the source of all of this. He now says it's not 65.9 trillion. It's, I think, 202 trillion. Well, this is 2010. So from 2007 to 2010, this unpayable debt has tripled. It's triply unpayable. Right? Now, looking at that, and in 2007 he was saying hyperinflation was the way out for these people because that's the only thing they know how to do. I guess it's hyperinflation, right? Double hyper. Because it's now triple the problem. All right. So we're facing the problem that the monetary system in some way or other is going to come down. And then that will lead, as they always do, to something that's called a depressionary phenomenon. Right? Destruction of jobs, people out of work, people thrown out of their homes, whatever. Dislocations in the production of food, for instance, let alone transportation. All sorts of problems along those lines. All right, so looking at that coming down the track, looking at that runaway engine coming down the track, we have to do something. And the thing that we absolutely need to have is a new currency unit. All of this other talk about government finances and banking and all the rest, if the currency unit is unsound, forget it. Right, if you have blood poisoning, there's not much point in having a heart transplant operation. Because the poisonous blood, the infected blood, will kill the new heart. Right. Same problem in the monetary system. We absolutely need to have a change in the currency unit, get back to a sound currency unit. And there is a way to do it. We can do it state by state. If, and there's the big capital I, if we educate the legislators, and if we mobilize, and actually educate first, and mobilize enough people at the grassroots. I'm not talking about 60% or 70%. It's probably something much more along the lines of 15 or 20% of the population paying attention to this and talking to the legislators, because legislators respond to whoever sends those emails, whoever makes those phone calls, right? Just numbers to them. I was talking to somebody the other day in the state legislature here in Virginia. He said, well, on most bills, we get four or five people calling us on a bill. That's an avalanche. Most people are not paying any attention to what's going on in the state legislatures, the average citizen. So we're not talking about having to get 90% of the population behind this. It's a relatively small number, and I think that's certainly doable. And, in fact, the worse this economy becomes, the more people we'll be able to recruit because, as you said earlier, people are beginning to wake up for the first time in my experience, 30 years worth of experience in this field or more. This is really the first time to look around and say, my gosh, a lot of people who understand something's wrong. They're not quite sure what it is. They certainly don't have a grasp on what ought to be done, but they know something's wrong. This is like a fellow who's driving along, clunk, 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 the transmission's starting to go, there's something wrong with the car. What he doesn't realize is he has square wheels on the car. At some stage, he's going to stop that car and get out and notice, oh, the wheels are square. No wonder it's shaking itself to pieces. I need to replace those. Well, that's the Federal Reserve System. It's the square wheel in this economic system that we have. That has to be replaced. And the question is, well, how do we do it? We can't do it from the top down. We have to do it from the bottom up. It has to be done one way or the other. And actually, the bottom up is better than the top down, because if you think what kind of a statute might Congress give us to replace the Federal Reserve, it probably would not be one that was, informed by market principles, right? Because they all tend to think in bureaucratic solutions up there. Whereas an alternative currency system, when it's put in, it's going to be driven entirely by market pressures. So you're going to get something that's much better from the point of view of accommodating itself to a free market and therefore a free society than anything you're going to get out of Washington in a top-down, one-size-fits-all solution.
Edwin?
So we have, all I'm saying is we really have an opportunity here. There's a big crisis, yes, and great dangers, but we have an opportunity for the first time in a long time, and we have to make use of it.
Edwin?
Yep.
We do have a couple of callers, which whenever you're ready to start taking some of those calls.
Whenever you like.
We have Joyce Rosenwald waiting. We also have Amanda Moore, who you're familiar with, waiting.
Yeah.
And we do have a question before I open up the phone lines. One of the questions was, what is the impact of Bernanke's actions on the world? And can we start, does it make sense to try to start with a state bank and how you go about that?
Well, let's take the state bank first. What good is a state bank running on a faulty currency? All right. The problem is the currency. It's not the banking system per se. I mean, the banking system gave us this currency. But basically, the currency is faulty. And if you, let's say you had a state bank, and you had the most prudent people running it, and then you have hyperinflation because the Federal Reserve note destroys itself, then where are you? All right. The state bank cannot solve the currency problem. If you had an alternative currency and you put a state bank on the alternative currency, that's another story. I'd be perfectly willing, as it were, to sign on to that as a viable alternative. But that's the second stage. Stage one is the currency. Stage two is the state bank. And, in fact, if you had an alternative currency along the lines of the type of thing that I've been promoting, you would, in fact, have a kind of state bank because you'd have to start off with the state depository to be running this thing. So it would be just one more step to open that thing up and set up some kind of loan accounts for the people that were using it so that some of those monies, at least, could be put into investment of one kind or another. So, yes, that would work. Now, what is the effect of Bernanke on the rest of the world? Well, what's the rest of the world doing? They're looking at the Federal Reserve note as a world reserve currency, and Bernanke is blowing the bottom out of it, going to hyperinflation. So what is the rest of the world thinking? How do we get away from this rotting vegetable currency? They have to be planning that. And that's very dangerous to us because to the extent that they start bailing out internationally of the use of Federal Reserve notes so that its world reserve currency value drops because it's not used as much, that's an inflationary event. I should put it the other way around. That reduces the purchasing power of Federal Reserve notes, which will have a price inflationary effect. It feeds into the worst scenario. And we have to remember one other thing, too. We have enemies in this world. I mean, the Chinese are not going to do things for us in terms of international currency maneuvers. And they're in a position where they could do quite a lot of damage to us if it served their interest. And remember, that's a totalitarian society. They're not really concerned with what happens to the average Chinese. They're only concerned with what happens to the party and the People's Liberation Army. And if there's some way that they could greatly increase their political influence in that segment of the world, Central Asia there, at our expense, why wouldn't they? So it's not just an economic problem here. Our friends in Washington and New York have put us into a very difficult political position, too, if you didn't have enough to worry about.
Are you ready to start taking some calls?
Whenever.
Mama Cooks, if you'll open up our friend Joyce Rosenwald, we'd let her come on and ask a question. Joyce, are you live?
Yeah, I'm here.
We hear you loud and clear. What's your question for Dr. Vieira?
My question is, if it's supposed to be by consent, why can't we just withdraw our consent to use that money and absolutely demand that the governors give us state banks with alternative money? Aren't we supposed to be on a dual money system? We either have the Federal Reserve, and then we're supposed to have United States notes. Why can't we just demand that they go back, provide United States notes, and give the people a choice? Let them use Federal Reserve notes if they want, or let them use the United States notes if they want. I think I know which one would win.
Well, that's what I'm proposing, except when you're talking about United States notes, that can't come out of any state treasury.
No, I understand.
That has to come out of Washington, so you're back to Congress again. You're back to that black hole, right?
Well, that's just it. Why can't we go back to the dual system they had after the Civil War, separate but equal?
Why can't we get rid of the central government
if the people don't want it?
Oh, well, that's what I'm proposing, but I don't think you can do it starting at the Washington level. You have to start at the state level.
Exactly.
The problem is, we right now, at this moment, if the average American wanted to walk away from the Federal Reserve System, there's no reason that he couldn't on his own adopt some alternative currency in his financial transactions. That's perfectly legal. Title 31 of the United States Code, Section 5118D, as in dog, D2, is the statute. There's absolutely no problem doing that, legally speaking. But it's a very cumbersome process for the average person, mainly because most people don't even know about it. So you have a problem of educating other people, and then if you're in business, you've got an accountant and a lawyer, and God knows what you have to do. There are tax problems, depending on what you use as the alternative currency, differential kinds of taxation. So it has to be done to solve all of those, what they call transaction costs. To minimize those, at least, it has to be done through a state government, because the state government has a lot of throughput in terms of what they collect in taxes and what they pay out in government expenditures. So immediately you have a big player in any state's market. And once that big player is there, and a lot of people interacting with the state certainly as taxpayers or in some instances creditors of the state, they now have an incentive to use that alternative currency, which they're either paying to the state or getting from the state, in their private transactions. And now the alternative currency spreads through the private economy. And what I would see is a dual price structure. You'd have prices set in Federal Reserve notes. They're already out there. And prices would begin to be set in this alternative currency. Certainly they'd be set right away in state expenditures and taxation. There'd be a two-tier price structure. And then people would choose which one to use.
Exactly. That's
exactly. Just what you're saying. That's exactly what would happen. And I think we're both pretty much in agreement on which way people would go if they were given the choice.
This is where I was coming from. I'm a legal researcher, and it's all contracts, and I knew there had to be a contract signed by the governors in 1933 to agree to go along with the program. Well, I finally found it. I found the contract signed by the governor of California, and I found the document that the Bar Association presented him with. I tracked down the laws that they immediately put on the books, and very interestingly, I found notice to one that's uncodified. I guess they didn't want us to find it. Anyway, to make a long story short, it's by contract. And I believe we can present contracts to our governors telling them we know exactly what's been done to us. We understand we've been conquered by the bankers in 1933. And the conqueror has the right to make the law and make the money, because after all, the law follows the money, doesn't it? Therefore, we don't have to have all this international law brought down on our heads and treaty laws and everything else by which we are losing our liberty and freedom. Without the people, there is no government. We are the people. Why don't we just present the governors with an ultimatum? We're offering you a new contract, and everything is negotiable. So let's sit down and negotiate. We don't like the system you have us in under anymore. We don't want to participate in it. We don't want the laws that go along with the money. So here's the offer we're making you. We're going to repudiate the debt. I think the bankers got enough of our money. We're not going to give them another dime. I believe we could create currency to use inside the country, because I remember I found a case that stated we have to use Federal Reserve notes within the territorial United States. But we have to deal in gold outside of the country, because the United States has no authority to tell other countries what kind of money they have to accept from us. Now, I believe the American people know they've come to a crossroad. This may be their last chance. And I honestly believe that the American people would be very happy to turn in their silver, gold, and gems and sell on the outside market to get hard currency to use outside of the country, and then we could begin to rebuild what they have destroyed through their rules and regulations and treaties. When they signed the treaty with the United Nations, the UNIDO Treaty, to send our jobs out of the country, when the treaty itself stated it could result in loss of jobs in America, what kind of public officials did we have that signed a treaty like that? They agreed to send our jobs offshore, and then they passed rules and regulations making it impossible for employers to keep jobs in the country. We have to reverse a hell of a lot of things besides the money. But like I said, I don't think the American people would object to making that kind of an investment in the future, because the future is their children and their grandchildren, and they've got to leave them something. They can't leave them a communist gulag to live on, because that's where we're heading.
Amen to that, Joyce. I think you've given Edwin quite a bit to respond to, and I do want to give the other callers an opportunity to get in here. I appreciate you calling in, Joyce. Thank you. Edwin, that's a lot to respond
want
to.
I don't disagree with anything that she said in principle, but I don't want to bite off more than I can chew. And the example I think I gave you earlier today when we talked, but the example I always give to people, imagine I was a woman in an automobile. This is Columbia, right, the woman that's the symbol of America. Columbia has been in an automobile accident, serious automobile accident. They wheel her into the operating room, and we're the trauma surgeons, and she has her femoral artery is cut, and she's bleeding to death. She's had a heart attack from the trauma of this accident, and she has a very bad case of acne, and she needs breast implants. Now, is the first thing that we're going to do, you know, send to Japan for the best breast implants and Botox and so forth? No. First thing we're going to do is stop the bleeding, because if we don't stop the bleeding, she's going to die, right? Then we work on the heart condition, because once the bleeding has stopped, we have to get the circulation going again. Then later on, maybe we'll get around to the cosmetic surgery, right? One thing at a time. And the point I make is you can go to bed on Friday and wake up on Monday and find this monetary system in collapse. We've got to be able to do something to be capable of functioning economically if that kind of circumstance occurs. And then number two, if you have that kind of an economic breakdown, the powers that be coming out of Washington and some of these state capitals as well, tied in with FEMA and Homeland Security, all in one seamless web, if you will, of the spider operation, what are they going to do under those circumstances? Well, they're going to clamp down with their police mechanism, police state mechanism. So that's job two. And I think that those two can be accomplished at the state level. I'm not too worried about the governors, though. Every state that I know of is a state that runs on the principle of legislative supremacy. The governor has little authority coming out of the Constitution of that state, and it's highly qualified and controlled by the statutes that the legislature passes. So we get control of one state legislature, and we're going to be able to take the steps necessary, at least in that state, to get control. And then I'm willing to bet that politically that kind of reform will sweep across the country, because people will realize, A, that they need it, and B, that there's no alternative.
Can I ask you a question that maybe you'll be able to answer, because I haven't been able to get an answer from anyone else? I understand the status of Texas, because if Texas versus white, they can be either a state in the union or an independent nation state. And based on that, they have to sign a contract every year to use the Federal Reserve notes. If we can get one state, I think the rest will, it'll be like a domino effect. How do we get to the governor of Texas?
Well, I don't know. Isn't he the one that went to the Bilderberg meeting last time around? Rick Perry?
Yep.
Isn't that the man?
Perry.
Yeah, isn't he still there?
Yes.
So apparently he has one. I mean, he talks about Texas independence. He talks a lot about 10th Amendment type attitudes, at least. He affects those. But apparently he has one leg on each side of the yellow line.
He's
so
a
I'm not
shill
so sure.
Selling the roads off to the Queen.
Yeah, so, you know, my view is when the check clears, I'll believe there's money in the political account, if you know what I mean. When I see them take these steps that I think are necessary, then I'll believe it. But until then, no. Talk is cheap.
We have Amanda Moore online. Say hello, Edwin.
Hello, Amanda. How are you?
Oh, Dr. Ed, I'm just grand. Thank you for being on this call tonight. You're enlightening a lot of people. The reason that I'm chiming in, of course, is because we have a vested interest here in South Carolina. Representative Michael Pitts introduced the Model State Act for the monetization of gold and silver and gold coin with respect to essential sovereign functions here in our state. And he, I believe, is online tonight. And he even went so far as to contact all of the other state legislators to invite them to this conference call this evening so that they could hear you talk about the Model State Act for the monetization of silver and gold coin. So we're really excited about it. My question to you is, if you had one thing that you wanted to say to Representative Mike Pitts about that and about pushing that piece of legislation, what would it be? And when would you like to come to South Carolina for that to get together with our state legislators, as we've spoken in the past? If he can manage to get them together.
Well, that depends on when you can manage to get them together, right?
Right.
If I were to say one thing to these people, don't pay any attention to the bloody media. I remember when he was promoting that bill, there was something in the media about some professor of economics who said that this was unconstitutional because it violated the Commerce Clause or some nonsense like that.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You simply can't. How many legislators, state legislators, told me, oh, they don't want to get involved with this alternative currency because it might appear to be fringe? Fringe to whom? Fringe
right.
to these people in the media that don't know A from B in this area? I mean, anyone who thinks that the Federal Reserve System is going to survive my lifetime and I'm getting on in years is fringe. All right? Anyone who thinks that a debt currency system can function in a complex free market economy is fringe. Anyone who doesn't think that the states have the authority to adopt their own currency is really fringe, because the Supreme Court's already ruled on that twice, right? The fringe people, or the people on the fringe, are on the other side of this issue. They're the ones who have had control from, 1933. 1933 was the time when they got quite a bit of what they wanted. They've had control of the monetary and banking system of this country solidly since 1933, and they've made a first-class mess out of it, domestically and internationally. And they're telling us that they know what they're doing and we don't?
Oh,
madness.
Yes, sir.
It's madness. And we're the ones that are going to have to pay the price for this, not them. They'll be living in the south of France. We don't have any problem, in terms of bailouts. For them, it's the average American who's going to suffer the consequences of this. And the point I make is, look, no one is suggesting that we're going to set up an exclusive new monetary system. First place, we can't do that because the one centered around the Federal Reserve is coming out of Washington, D.C. We can't get control of Congress. We can't change that legislation. We're going to set up an alternative monetary system and competition in money. And if we're wrong, no one will use this new system, but then no one will be hurt. If we're right, everyone will start using this system, and to some degree we'll salvage this economy, at least creating a foundation for reformation of it. So I can't see what the possible argument against it can be, because it's not a matter that's going to cost the particular state government millions and millions of dollars to set up. And if it doesn't work, and people find that it's not advantageous to use the alternative currency, they won't use it, right? They buy Colgate instead of Pepsodent or whatever, right? That's called competition. And that's usually how we find out what the best products are, by laying them all on the table and seeing what the consumers want to buy. Well, money is no different, fundamentally, except now we're in a very serious situation where we need this in order perhaps to salvage the economy entirely.
Right.
So I really don't see the practical argument against this.
Yes, sir, but they sure demonized Representative Pitt in the press. He was made to look like a complete fringe candidate or person. And, you know, he started getting some traction with this. And we've got a lot of people in the State House now who are going to support this. We actually walked the halls, knocked on doors, we talked to them, we tried to explain this bill to them and explain to them what the situation is. And apparently it was pretty effective. Patricia Wheat and, you know, a lot of other folks went with me, and we had a great, great sit-down with these legislators. And a lot of them do understand it. And Representative Pitts is certainly a hero in this state. He's one of the most effective legislators on record today in South Carolina. And he's a big fan of yours, Dr. Edwin Beer. I just wanted to mention that. And I'll let you speak, sir. Go ahead. The rest of the night is yours. I'm sorry.
May I inject a Beckman here? I'm going to call
it
a Beckman.
Hello, Mr. Beckman. Hello, Red.
Red.
How are you?
Red, you want to say hello?
Hello.
Hi there. Good to talk to you, sir.
I'm injecting on behalf of Mr. Beckman. This is Terry Dodd. Red always says that the problem, the most serious problem that we've got is not the tyrants. It's the people who believe their lies. And this is a classic case of that that you guys are talking about right now. We know that the international banksters and the power elite control the media. And therefore, they have control of the lies. And that's really the problem here. They demonize things. They don't tell the whole truth. And what we've got to do, and this is what Edwin keeps saying, is that you've got to have grassroots support when you go and you propose a bill, because the people in those committees that are going to vote against it need to understand that you got 100,000 people ready to vote them out of office if they don't listen up. Because you're fighting against a media that's absolutely stacked against you and a populace out there that is totally addicted to believing the lies. And now, Edwin, I'll let you take it from there.
Well, I think there's a great deal of truth to that. And it's the difficulty is most people have no experience about what we're discussing. You look at Europe as a for instance. The Europeans put in the euro. Now, I'm not in favor of the euro or the European Union. But look what they did. They had a number of countries that were engaged in international trade with each other. People were used to using more than one currency. European Union folks come along and say, well, we're now going to introduce our own centralized currency. And how do they do it? Well, they put that in as an alternative currency in each one of these different countries, and let a price structure develop in euros versus lira, euros versus marks, euros versus pesetas, whatever it was. And then once that had stabilized and those markets were now capable of using euros, and these Europeans were perfectly capable of using more than one currency because they had that experience for a long time, then they could withdraw from the system the local currency, and the euro becomes the central currency, all right? Americans haven't had that experience. So this is very novel and really alien to them when you start talking about competing currencies, alternative currencies. So that's one thing that they have to be brought up to speed on. And secondly, the legislators, at least what I read about the black propaganda that they were putting out in South Carolina, this idea that, well, a state doesn't have the authority to do this. They have to be educated in the fact that, yes, they do have this authority. They perfectly well. There are some things they can't do. They can't generate their own paper currency, no bills of credit, Article 1, Section 10. They can't coin their own coins, a South Carolina coin. No state shall coin money. All right. So there are some things they can't do. But the Constitution makes it perfectly clear that the only thing they can make legal tender in payment of debts is gold and silver coin. That's their reserve power and duty. It's right there. And the Supreme Court has ruled that a state is not required to use what Congress has designated as a legal tender if the state determines that for some other reason it needs it to use an alternative monetary unit for its own financial transactions. So state legislators have to be made aware of that. And then they have to be made aware of what I think is the bottom line on this. They are responsible for the public health, safety, welfare, and economic well-being of the people in their state, ultimately. They can't shrug their shoulders and say, well, no, I'm leaving this to Ben Bernanke, I'm leaving this to Janet Napolitano, I'm leaving this to Barack Obama, or whoever it is in Congress. It's their responsibility. They are there for that purpose. And if they can't figure out how to make those how to fulfill those responsibilities, then they better get out and go work at a Starbucks. I think the people have to tell them that. We're now in a crisis. Congress is out of control. I don't care who's running it, the Republicans or Democrats. The bankers really don't know what they're doing. Wall Street is only interested in lining its own pockets. We're going to have all sorts of international problems with currency wars and economic infighting. And we have to worry about dealing with the basic welfare of the average American where he lives in his local community. And that is the state legislator's responsibility. And if he won't pick up that ball, well, then he has to leave office and put somebody else in. It's as simple as that.
Well, we got, we have several who I've spoken to about this. Chip Limehouse is one who said he'd love to see this enacted. And Jeff Duncan, he likes the idea of it. And then Mike, of course, has his own Liberty Caucus, I think, that there's like probably 18 or 19 who would sign on to this bill. And, of course, we just need them to vote for it, not necessarily sign on to it, but definitely vote for it.
How about your governor?
My governor is Governor Nikki Haley-elect. Right now, Mark Sanford is still in there. I'm sure that he would be willing to do this. He's a big fan of Ron Paul's and called it the Fed. He's a liberty-minded fellow. So I think that he would definitely not have any problem with this whatsoever. And if Nikki Haley follows suit, I believe that she would not have a problem with this either.
Because that would be important if you could have the governor sign on to it as well, obviously.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't see any problem with that.
Yeah. Well, there it is. You have a bill. You have a hardcore of what they used to call the usual suspects, right, that it's supporting it. And now the job is just to increase the number of at least people who vote for it, and maybe at a minimum that the governor will take a neutral position. You certainly don't want the governor to be antagonistic and oppose it, right?
Right.
Minimum, the governor will say, well, I'll do whatever the legislature tells me to do. Probably you want the governor to support the thing. And I think at some stage what you'll need is something along the lines of what I was suggesting earlier, that you get a dog and pony show of first-class witnesses down there to tell these state legislators in some kind of an official hearing exactly how bad the situation is.
Well,
you know, I don't think they know. So many I talk to, the first impression I get from them is, well, it's not as bad as I'm telling them, right? Mm-hmm. I'm kind of, dark clouds, all dark clouds, right? And then, well, after a while, they say, well, maybe it is that bad, but, it's not going to happen that soon. And then, well, okay, it's pretty bad, and it may happen sooner than we want it to happen. But the people in Washington will solve that problem. That's their problem. They'll solve it. Federal Reserve will get around this. Right? It's one form of delay and denial after another. And unfortunately, the clock is ticking while they're denying. And eventually, they run out of time. I used to have a mathematics professor. That was his line. He said, you can't take a lot of time in these problems. You've got to be able to solve these problems quickly. He said, because life is like a slice of bologna. You know, every day, and time is a knife. Every day you cut off a little slice and you consume it. And no matter how thin you slice it, one day you're going to end up out of time and full of bologna.
Yeah.
you've got to use that time wisely with solving mathematics problems, these complex mathematics problems, right? And it's even worse in terms of the political situation, economic situation now. I mean, it would have been fine to debate these things for a year or 2 years, 10 years ago. Now, no.
And Red, once again, you've been awfully quiet.
Starting point.
Red's been awfully quiet for too
there?
Long. We need to let him jump in here before he gets a complex or something.
I'm enjoying being quiet. I'm enjoying all the conversation. And I was thinking about an area that hasn't been really addressed, and that is that we've got millions of people out there, families, that have been dependent upon government, city, county, state, federal. They have developed a dependence on government to help them survive and such. And we need to communicate with these people that a lot of them already have had their homes foreclosed, and they've moved in with kinfolks or moved into a camp trailer or whatever. They have no job. Talking currency to those people, really, it's above their heads, it's over their heads and such. But what they're going to eat the next day and the next week or whatever is the thing that's on their mind. And we need to communicate. We need people that will communicate with these people and communicate with them with the kind of language that they understand, and that is, hey, we're going to have a problem with our food distribution. If this thing comes unglued much more, we're going to have a problem with the food distribution. We're going to have a problem with this inflation thing, and you may, you know, you may have to stand back and just wish that you had some money to buy some food. And so we have to come to a mental situation where the people recognize that their standard of living is going to be damaged much more severe than it is already. Nobody's really been talking about how the standard of living in this country has been deteriorating on a daily basis almost. And so, you know, telling the people about the monetary thing just isn't going to fill their bellies. We're going to have to communicate with the people out there and try to help them to become resourceful in their own efforts. They can't depend on the government to take care of them. They're going to have to figure out how to take care of themselves. And, of course, having grown up, a lot of my growing up in the 30s, I remember what happened then. And, of course, it is complicated today because our population is more than double, I think, today what it was back then. So our problems can be doubled. And, of course, people didn't have the dependency on government back then that they have today. And so what I worry about is that if we don't deal with this type of thing, this is what makes panic happen come our way when people don't have anything to eat, they don't have anything to take care of their family and such, and then you have panic and you have panic results. You have the results are not very pretty. And so I'm so thrilled with, you know, having the good minds that we have working on this this currency thing, because that's a problem that's going to have to be solved. And of course, I have a question for Dr. Vieira, and that is, what would happen if the Congress of the United States canceled the corporate charter of the Federal Reserve Bank, and why couldn't they just take over the assets of the Federal Reserve Bank system? It would solve a lot of problems if that were to happen, simply because it would stop the bleeding of paying all the interest on this massive debt to the Fed. And of course, from what I am able to find out, the Fed holds about half of the debt of the federal government, And that's an asset to the Federal Reserve, and it's a liability to the people of this country. And if the assets of the Federal Reserve Bank were transferred to the U.S. Treasury Department, it would probably, if the Fed holds half of the debt, it would solve half of the debt that quick. And I think that this is something, the potential for something like this happening, I don't think it's that far out of reach of our Congress. If they get their backs to the wall, which is about to happen or has happened for many of them already, I think that something like that could happen. But my concern, my basic concern is, what's going to happen with Joe Sixpack and his wife and their three kids? What's going to happen with those people? How are they going to make it through this this stormy period in our American history? And I think that I don't know, but it's not a pretty picture. And let's hope that we don't get in that bad situation. And of course, everybody's afraid of this massive inflation. I don't anticipate the real massive inflation because there aren't enough people out there with enough money to spend anyway. And so they might put a high price on something, but are they going to find anybody with the money to buy it at the high price? And so I don't worry about the inflation as much as some people do, but I'll quiet down and enjoy listening again.
I believe we may. Are you ready to take another call, or do we want to make a comment to that, Edwin?
Oh, I don't know. I might make a comment. I mean, obviously, the Congress, if it wanted to, could attempt to, I don't know, dissolve the Federal Reserve, rein it in some ways. I mean, they have a provision in the Federal Reserve Act in which they reserve the right to alter, amend, or repeal any provision of the Act at any time. So there's no reason they couldn't take some of these steps, at least in terms of nationalizing the assets of the bank. And if the asset of the bank is actually the nothing more than the IOU or the Treasury, then essentially it cancels the Treasury IOU, and there's no interest to be paid on that. Of course, your problem then becomes, once again, goes back to the currency issue. You got prices out there in the marketplace and the bank. These contracts are made payable or were understood to be payable in Federal Reserve notes. What becomes the new currency at that stage? So they still have to deal with it. I mean, they don't get around that problem unless all they do is cancel that debt. And then you've got the Treasury essentially running the banking system. I'm not sure if that doesn't put us in hotter water. The one thing that will happen with a currency changeover is now investors will come out of the woodwork. I mean, the problem we have now is people don't have jobs because investment money is not coming in to create those jobs. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the marketplace. Banks are sitting on a huge amount of lendable funds, but no one's willing to take them, even at the very low interest rates that the banks are offering, because no one is sure. Borrow some money today, a year from now you won't be able to pay it back. So you have that phenomenon that the economists used to call pushing on a string. The banks are capable of making the loans, but they have to be two parties to make a loan. And the businessmen, the entrepreneurs out there in large numbers are not willing to risk that. So that has a very heavy effect on the job market. But as soon as you put a sound currency into place, what you're going to find is all that investment interest will perk up. In fact, pick your state. I don't care what state it is. Texas. Texas puts in, South Carolina puts in a sound alternative currency. It'll be the only place in the world that has a sound alternative currency. What do you think the effect will be economically? Now, I agree with Red. I mean, if we're facing one of these real meltdowns, and especially if it's a depressionary meltdown, that's the worst of all possible worlds because everybody's out of work. Then you're going to have tremendous social dislocation. That's why for the last, 5 years, 6 years, I've been promoting the revitalization of the militia because the militia is the way that you deal with these problems at the local level. People themselves at the local level deal with these problems. I don't seem to get much traction on that issue. You know, I like to think of this as M&Ms, the two M's. The first M, the money question. Now, some people will listen to that. But as soon as I start talking about the second M, they run for cover. And I'll tell
you
something.
After we take a call, I'd kind of like for you to spend a few minutes really clearly defining for these listeners exactly what the militia is, because nobody really understands that. They don't get it. And I talk about it all the time, and people go, well, you know, they accept it after they listen. But if they don't listen, if they don't start out with a little bit of an open mind, they just close off to it. But once they listen, once they understand, then they go, oh, well, that's not what the media has been telling us, you know. So we have a caller from area code 610 that may be Joyce Rosenwald again with another question. If you have a live mic.
Actually, it's me, but Joyce is on the line with me. We're conferenced in. I've got a question for both Red Beckman and Dr. Vieira. And let me start with Dr. Vieira. You mentioned something about the states taking control of the money. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, well, how much of the states, as the Constitution was designed in both the state constitutions and the federal, how much of those states are left in order to take over? Because it was always my understanding that through the war and emergency powers and everything else that they've done, that there's really not much of a state left, that we're really just an appendage of the federal government at this point. So how would we even affect such a change if we're impotent, if we really have no power to fight the federal government?
Well, I don't understand that that's true. I mean, I hear people talk about this, and I say, well, where's the statute that did this, and is the statute constitutional? I mean, it's obviously
But I don't think anything that's being done today is constitutional. I think they've taken the Constitution and tossed it aside. I think it sits there, and it has to be there, because nothing could exist without it, but I don't believe it's referenced. I don't believe that anything that anybody does in Congress, or I'm in Pennsylvania, and I don't think that anybody in the Pennsylvania legislature follows either the state constitution or the federal constitution. So,
well,
I don't
well
think
then,
that,
I mean, you know, assuming that's true in the practical sense, the de facto sense, right, as a fact they don't, well, then what kind of a system do you have? It's some kind of anarchistic system. If they're not following the Constitution in Richmond, why do I have to follow the statutes that they pass illegally? I'm not bound by them. If they're not bound by the charter of their existence as a government, then I'm not certainly bound by anything that they do in that role of usurpers that they're performing. There's a circular
argument.
That's
exactly what we have.
And then the answer is to go back to these people who are, I'm assuming that they're legitimately elected. Let's not talk about Mr. Obama, right? That's another question. But these people sitting in the state legislatures, state governors, I'm assuming that they are legitimately elected under their constitutions and electoral statutes. And so they're exercising power in principle constitutionally. And what we need to do is to require them to pass some real constitutional legislation. That's the practical problem.
Okay. Let me take you to something Joyce said. Maybe Joyce can jump in on that. Joyce was saying that, Joyce, let me ask you, what did you say about the money? We're outside of the United States. We have a contractual obligation to do what? What was that that you said?
No, I can't remember the name of the case, but there were a lot of cases filed after the Federal Reserve came in 1933 and did away with the money. And apparently they told the people that we had to use internal money, but gold for outside of the country, because the federal government couldn't tell other countries what money they had to accept. And, of course, I didn't believe a word of that when I read it, because it's totally absurd. But the reason we're not using the Constitution anymore is because We're under an emergency. We're under martial law rule under necessity. And the main object is protect the de facto government at any cost. They're the only people they're concerned about. They're not concerned about the rest of us. And if we have to clean up the money system, we got to clean up the emergency system, because we can't have real money as long as that emergency continues.
Well, yeah, there's no emergency law or martial law that overrides the Constitution. That does not exist.
Why don't you tell that to Congress? Because that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, I told them. Listen, I'm not responsible for them acting in a de facto illegal fashion. All right? But they're acting in a de facto illegal fashion doesn't make what they're doing legal. No matter how many times they act that way, it isn't legal. And
no,
they can talk about martial law all they want. Look in the Constitution and find the words martial law.
It's not there.
Find the authorization for emergency powers. It's not there.
It's not there.
It's
but
not
why
there.
The,
now,
but
because
the people,
we don't stand up to them.
That's right. It's our fault. We
that's
can't
right.
say
somebody
Washington
kicks, somebody kicks
doesn't
in your front door
it.
And goes into your living room and takes over your house, and you just sit there meekly and say, oh, martial law and emergency powers. I guess there's nothing I can do about this. He'll be in there forever.
That's right. It's not Washington. It's the people. They won't
yes,
do anything
Mon,
about
it. It's Ma and Pa Kettle, if you will.
No, but
exactly.
Also,
it's the people.
It's also, wait a minute. Hold on a second. It's also the international community as well. Because this is where I was getting to with this is what Joyce, when she was talking about inside and outside the United States, this is what triggered my question. Because I sit here and I look in courtrooms in this country, and I can walk into any courtroom and I'm going to be faced with one of those gold fringe flags. The President of the United States is going to be on United States soil, always standing in front of a gold fringe flag. But I'm going to tell you something. You find me a picture of Obama, Bush Sr., I don't care, any of them, standing in front of a gold fringe flag outside the United States. On foreign soil, they stand in front of the proper flag, the flag that's in Title IV of the statutes. So they're obviously operating when they're inside the country. They're tearing us apart, and they're acting unconstitutionally, and they don't care. But outside of the country, they're playing the game properly. Because they're not walking around. All those gold fringe flags that sit behind Obama when he's making statements, well, he doesn't even put flags behind him now, but when he is standing in front of a flag on U.S. soil, those flags are gold fringed, military flags. But
and what's the consequence of that? What if they put the Nazi flag in back of them? Would that mean that they have Hitler law? I mean, what does the flag have to do with anything?
As far as I'm concerned, the flag tells me what law I'm walking into. They're giving me fair warning of what they're going to do to me and how they're going to do it. So when you're walking into a courtroom in this country and you got a gold fringe flag sitting there, well, it may not be a military court, it may not be some court, but I'll tell you what. I don't believe it's a court of the United States of America. I don't believe it's a constitutional Article III court.
Oh, because it has that flag.
Because that's exactly right.
It has that flag. Okay.
Well, if a ship pulls up to a harbor and it's flying the flag of Norway and you step aboard that ship and commit a crime, where'd you commit your crime?
Can I say something, please?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Under Lincoln, he destroyed the constitutional judiciary. And he gave you the Department of Justice, which is nothing but an agency under the executive. And in 1934, Congress franchised the bar to create an entire new Supreme Court system, and then they gave them the authority to create all the lower courts. We have a private court system. It has nothing to do with the people's court because it had nothing to do with the people's law. It's all for their private international law. So we don't have a court system to go to. Unfortunately, the American people have been left without remedy. No place to go for remedy.
Well, you know what?
Really?
I'm thinking now that you say that, hold on a second. Maybe, Joyce, the remedy is outside of the United States since they have to...
Exactly. So I have been telling people to set a condition precedent that they are not citizens of the United States. Publish it through open and notorious notice, which they are doing, and then I'm telling them that anything they own that is not encumbered, mortgaged, payments, go and register it on the public side of the register, take it off, I mean on the private side, take it off of the public side, begin to withdraw everything that the federal government took under Senate Document 43. All property resides in the states. Look at your deed. You're a tenant. You can't even own your own home. They've taken everything, and we got to start taking it back. And the first thing we got to take back is ourselves. We have to claim ownership of ourselves, and we can only do that by leaving the political forum. If it isn't a country, all we're living in is a society, a political society. We're citizens of a corporate political society. We're not a citizen of a nation anymore. And if we want to take it back, we left it one at a time when we chased the federal benefits and became citizens of the corporation. Now we got to leave it one at a time until there's enough of us to be a force to make a difference, and then we can demand anything we want.
But do we have to demand these things outside? I think we have to demand these things outside of whatever. See, I don't know what jurisdiction I'm sitting in. I know what jurisdiction I'm supposed to be sitting in, but I don't know what I'm really sitting in, because they don't act like I'm sitting in the jurisdiction of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Commonwealth, not the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And that's why I asked the question, if you think you're going to be able to change the money, how are you going to do that corrupt system?
That's just it. If you're going to claim to be sovereign and own yourself, you don't go in and ask questions or beg. You go in and tell them who you are and then demand what you want.
Who are we going to tell, though? I think we now – it just dawned on me that I think we now have to go outside, because inside is so politically corrupted, it is so foul, that there is no remedy here.
Well, there is a remedy. No, there is a remedy. When you announce that you're not a citizen of the United States any longer, you qualify your signature – and you are now back in the United States of America claiming your common law rights. Every time you go into a court, you go in under special pleading, Rule 9, 9A. You set a common law court, and that's where you have the right to demand what you're entitled to as a free person in the United States of America, the Republic.
Dr. Vieira?
What?
Is this something you want to comment on?
I've never had any experience with this, having spent time in, mostly the federal courts from, 1973. I don't go into them anymore because it's like spitting in the ocean and watch it rise. I've never run into any of this.
Well, it works. I'll be happy to tell you the procedure. It's really simple. You set the court. Is that not true? When you go into a court, you can set the court you want to be in? So we're setting the courts in the common law.
Well, certainly not always. I mean, I've had clients that were dragged into court. They didn't want to be there.
Well, I don't know anybody that wants to. Who in their right mind wants to go into a court?
Let me give you an example of what she's talking about, Edwin. I think you may understand what she's saying, but when Red Beckman, is talking to somebody about the Seventh Amendment. And he's talking about going in pro persona, not being represented, but going in as your own person and declaring the judge to be a government agent and telling that judge that because he's a government agent, he's incapable of making a finding of fact of law because of he's no longer impartial. He has no ability to make an impartial decision.
When were they not government agents? Go back and read Blackstone. These people were appointed by the king. I mean, the king and queen, king's bench, they used to call it, queen's bench. All right? They have never been in a situation where they weren't government agents.
I understand, but by doing that, you push them into a common law situation where they try to everything they can do to avoid you being operating under common law. But under the Seventh Amendment, if you go in and declare that judge incapable of making an impartial decision and demand a common law jury, which you're allowed under the Seventh Amendment, then you set the court. Is that not what you're saying, Joyce?
That's what I'm saying, but I also tell people you don't want to aggravate the judge. You want to go after the prosecuting attorney. Now, they claim you have to have a license to practice law. So if you set a common law court and you ask him for his license, he don't have one. Therefore, he can't be in the courtroom, and that's under their own laws. we have to use their own laws against them, because God knows we don't have any. So what you have
to... Well, let me add something to that, Joyce, because I don't know if everybody remembers this, but when they went after Kevorkian and they tried to convict him, they had a hell of a time to get a jury to convict him in the courts. And if you recall, the prosecutor, and I think it was in Ohio that they convicted him, the prosecutor in Ohio convened a common law court, and they said it on the news. They made a big deal out of it, and they also made a big deal that they had used a common law court in order to get the final conviction against Kevorkian. So it is possible that they can do it. I think, Dr. Vera, what I'm saying to you is, and I'm going to go back to the research of Dan Meter, because I just read some of that last night. You have, in this country, you have United States district courts, and you have district courts of the United States, two separate things. And I don't think that when I'm walking into a court of what we can now call a federal court, that that's an Article III court that was created by the Constitution. I think we're walking into a creature that was created by the Congress. And
you're
it's
right.
Molded into the Congress.
There are,
okay,
there
folks,
are
folks,
very
I
few Article III courts.
I don't want to break up a party, but I don't know that this is a particular topic that the folks that we've got a lot of people on here wanting to hear Dr. Vieira talk about certain issues, and I think we're maybe veering a little bit off of course, and I don't want to get too far off of course for him, because we've only got about another half hour to go in the show. If we need to extend it over, we can do that, but I really want to hear about the militia and let people understand exactly what a militia is. So, Edwin, if you would pop back in here, and you can finish whatever you've got on your mind related to that conversation, but I do want to get back on topic.
Well, I don't have much on my mind other than the last comment that was made on these district courts, U.S. District Court versus District Court of the United States. There are, of course, no district courts, courts of appeals, or any inferior courts whatsoever created by the Constitution of the United States. Article 3 leaves that, the existence of such things and what their jurisdiction might be, entirely to Congress. They are statutory creatures. They're not constitutional creatures. They're not even required. Some people at the time the Constitution was ratified thought that that provision was probably superfluous because the state courts would handle vast amounts of litigation, and then the Supreme Court could potentially hear appeals coming out of the state courts, and there wouldn't be any necessity for what we call today federal courts. But certainly there's no, I mean, the whole idea that these that there's a set of courts, lower courts coming out of the Constitution directly, just it isn't there. Go read it. Not true.
Well, Edwin, are you ready to shift back and talk about the
militia? Well, sure. And the whole point is, I try to be, in analyzing legal problems, I try to be somewhat scientific and look at what the evidence is. Constitution is the highest, how shall I put this, positive law. Well, actually, Declaration, because you can call it positive law as well, although the Declaration is based on the higher law, the natural law, all right? And what does the Constitution tell us in terms of the question security? Because you've got this whole Homeland Security propaganda that has been generated out of Washington since whenever, 9-11. Actually, they had stuff prepared before that, but certainly since 9-11. If you're worried about the question of quote-unquote Homeland Security, I don't like that term, but that's their term, so let's use it. And you say, all right, let's look in the Constitution and see where that term is used. Where do you find it? Where's the only place you find the word security in the U.S. Constitution? Well, it's the Second Amendment.
Second Amendment.
Right, of course.
Also,
no
the
regulated
word
militia. Well, leave that aside for the moment. Well regulated militia being necessary to security of a free state, right? Security, that's the only place it occurs. And it's a special kind of security. It's not the security of a police state, for instance, or the security of just any old kind of state without definition. It's the security of a free state. And that's interesting because if you go back to the preamble, you find a word related to security, the verb. It's the last of the points in the preamble. Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. So it's interesting that there's that tie-in, right? And as you pointed out, the word necessary is there. Well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's the only entity, institution, whatever, in the Constitution that the Constitution describes as being necessary. It doesn't say Congress is necessary. I guess we figured out probably it isn't. It doesn't say the president's necessary. It doesn't say the Supreme Court's necessary. It certainly doesn't say the inferior federal courts are necessary because we require them to be there. It doesn't say the Army and the Navy are necessary. Congress can have them or not have them. In fact, the founders were so worried about the Army that they said an appropriation for the Army couldn't last more than 2 years. Why is that? Because the House of Representatives comes in every 2 years. And all bills for raising revenue have to start in the House of Representatives. So you could have the people turn over the House of Representatives in 2 years and throw out the Army by not appropriating money for it. That's how much they thought about the Army. All right? It's the militia. A well-regulated militia. Now, we ask the question, what is that? And it's pretty easy because if you read the rest of the Second Amendment, it tells you. Well-regulated militia be necessary security of free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Ah, so the right of the people to keep and bear arms is something that has to do with the militia, and the militia is necessary to the security of a free state. So you read that amendment backwards. The important thing is to have a security of a free state. It's necessary to have a militia to do that, and the militia is based on this thing called the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Well, who are these things called the people? These are the same people in the preamble. This is the we the people. All right? People are ordained and established the Constitution. And why is that true? Well, it's a self-governing society. Right? So the people who are the source of law, the sovereigns, also have to be the ones who have the power of the sword in their hands ultimately. Because as Mao Zedong said, and quite correctly, political power grows out of the barrel of the gun. In practical terms. And that's what the Second Amendment says. Except in a little more principled fashion, because it's looking to a free state, not the kind of totalitarian thing that Mao Zedong set up in China. All right? The same principle. So we have a self-governing society. The people who are the governors, the people who are the sovereigns, have to have the ultimate control of the mechanisms of force. Right? Now, if you ask, well, what's a well-regulated militia? Constitution doesn't define that. In fact, if you go to the body of the Constitution, the original Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, it talks about the militia and Congress's ability to engage in certain kinds of regulation of the militia. And then in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, it talks about the president being commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states, but doesn't tell us what these things are. Well, that's because it didn't need to. Everybody knew what these things were. The militia of the several states were in existence prior to the Constitution's being ratified. They were in existence prior to the Articles of Confederation. In fact, the Articles of Confederation mentions them and talks about how the states are supposed to continue to maintain these militia. Now, if you go back historically during the pre-constitutional period, back to the early 1600s, you'll find that in one form or another, according to a certain pattern, these institutions existed in every colony and independent state, except for a while in Pennsylvania, because in the early days in Pennsylvania, the Quakers were in charge. And the Quakers, of course, pacifists. And they didn't want to pass any legislation to force people to participate in a militia, because all the militias were compulsory organizations. They were based on the total mobilization of, at that time, all able-bodied men. Because women were not really emancipated, and under the social customs of those days, they didn't believe that women should participate in paramilitary activity or military activity. So it was all able-bodied men from 16 or 15, 15 in Massachusetts, interestingly, 16 in most places, up to in the 50s and 60s. And the lower limit, of course, was a question of maturity, and the upper limit was a question of physical capability. You get, in those days, you get to be 50 years old, 55 years old. You probably had eyesight problems, you had rheumatism, whatever. You couldn't function in that kind of an operation. So they didn't require participation. But it didn't stop you from volunteering either, because you had a lot of the people who were officers that were superannuated men in their 50s or 60s. So it required everyone's participation. That was number one. Because you can't have a self-governing country unless people self-govern, right? It's not a spectator sport. You have to participate. And if the bottom line in self-government is controlling the mechanism of governmental force, then that means everyone has to participate in that in some way. Now, they didn't all have to carry guns. Let's just jump ahead on this. You take the Quakers and the Mennonites. Those were the two major, I think, pacifist religious denominations or persuasions at the time. And you find most of the militia statutes that were passed had some kind of exemption for the conscientious objector, because they weren't going to force those people to take action against their religious principles. So a Quaker didn't have, or a Mennonite didn't have to have a gun, and he didn't have to show up for militia training, and in that sense, at least military training. But what might he have to do? They didn't let him off. Number one, in many states or colonies before the independence, the Quakers had to buy guns for somebody else. They had there was a fine that was imposed on them. They had to pay for armaments for other members of the militia. In a number of states, they were given non-military duties. So if you had what they called an alarm, which might have been an attack by the Indians or the French, obviously. The French were the big enemies during the colonial period. Those people who were the exempted, conscientious objector, exempted class, they were told, well, you take the women and children to safety, or you take the cattle and the horses or whatever to safety, and you serve as spies or scouts. Now think about that one for a second. If you're in a battle with the French and you're caught as a militiaman, the law of that time was that you were a combatant and you had to be, you could be imprisoned, you could be held in custody, but you couldn't be shot outright. Unless, of course, it was a French Indian that caught you. That was a different situation. But in principle, all right, you were a combatant and you were subject to the laws of war, and that meant you couldn't be shot outright. What happens to a spy when he's caught? He's hanged. There's a death penalty for espionage at that time. All right? So these poor Quakers and Mennonites were actually given rougher duty than the typical militiamen. But the point was, everyone participated. Actually, the women participated to a certain extent, too, because if you were a widow, or maybe you were a spinster who was the head of the household in any event, there was no man in the household, no adult male in the house, but you had an apprentice, or you had a servant, or you had a minor son, more than 16 years old, but less than 21, living in the household, so they had to go into the militia. You were responsible financially for paying for their militia equipment. So even the women were brought into this to a certain extent through financial responsibility. So number one, everyone was a member. Number two, everyone who wasn't a conscientious objector had to have a firearm. And it was probably his own firearm, because most of the statutes said that they had to buy their own. You had to buy your own equipment. And if you were too poor, then they worked something out for you. They'd get you a job, or they'd sell some produce if you were a farmer, or the militia would get you a gun, or the town council would do it, whatever. The government, local government would get it. But in some way or another, they put a gun in your hands. And you were required to maintain personal possession of this thing in your home with a certain amount of ammunition. And in places like Rhode Island, I mean, they came around, they held what were called sights. They'd send a sergeant or an ensign or somebody around on a regular basis, show me your gun, show me your ammunition, make sure that you're qualified, that you had it all. And if you didn't, you were fined. And they had a whole series of penalties for failure to meet these requirements. And then you had to come out on a regular basis. Sometimes it was four times a year, six times a year. If a war was going on, it was more often for a regular muster, what they call musters and training. So they had everyone organized in the society. Now, in those days, it was primarily of a what I would call a paramilitary nature, because they were looking either to defend local areas from incursions of Indians to a large extent, or if you were on the seacoast in places like Carolinas or Virginia, pirates for a long time, 1600s and early 1700s, pirates were literally a problem. And then if you were, especially in New England, with close to Canada, of course, during that whole series of wars that England fought with France in the 1700s, it was constant Indian warfare, or sometimes open warfare with French troops, or it was this, what we would call today, I guess, guerrilla-type warfare that was going on there. So it was primarily a paramilitary or military or police-type activity. But that was the structure. And the whole point was to organize the entire community. Now, this did a couple of things. First, it organized the entire community for those activities. And the three of them that are mentioned in the Constitution with respect to the militia, execution of the laws, suppression of insurrections, and repelling invasions, kind of your classic list of Homeland Security duties. So it provided people with training, organization and training for that purpose. But the thing that always interested me about that structure was it brought all these people together on a regular basis at the local level because they were organized in what were typically called companies, militia companies, which were small numbers of people, maybe 30, 40, 50 people, usually never more than about 100, 120, depending on where you were. But they were organized at the neighborhood level, so among people that you knew, probably in some cases members of extended families. And during this 100-and-something years while this structure existed in all the colonies, and that's a fascinating thing, too. If you read the statutes of all of these colonies and independent states, which I have done, I think I've read essentially every one that existed, you will find how amazingly uniform they are in terms of the way they did this. And in fact, you can take most of the statutes, and if you take off the title and cover up the line on the book that tells you, you know, this is the statutes of Virginia, the statute of Massachusetts, it's pretty hard to tell which state any particular statute came from, unless it was a statute coming out of one of the southern states that had heavy slavery, because those statutes tended to have a thing called patrols in them, where they would send the militiamen out on a regular basis to make sure that the slaves were where they were supposed to be, that they weren't off congregating in a tippling house, because that could lead to some kind of rebellion, so they had a police function dealing with the slavery system. But it was a uniform structure. It lasted for about 150 years, depending on, you go way back into Virginia, for instance, Massachusetts, Plymouth Colony. So when you come to the time of the Articles of Confederation, come to the time of the Constitution, these structures were pretty much set in stone, at least in terms of precedent. This is what always had been done. And as I was about to say before, the thing that interested me about them was they were local organizations in which people could not have possibly missed the point that by being organized this way, having this armament and training, they were really the ones in control of their own government, ultimately. And the proof of the pudding was, at the two extremes, in Massachusetts, geographical extreme, Massachusetts, General Gage, he becomes the military governor of Boston, right? 1773. And Gage is concerned about rebellion of one kind or another. So he starts going, sending his troops out to try and collect the powder and cannon to begin with, I mean, the heavy armament that the militia had in various places. And there was a series of these events before eventually the Lexington and Concord shootout, the, you know, really resistance starts. There was more than one of these events. It didn't come to that level of shooting, that level of fighting. But you'd have to think about that situation. Gage was the legitimate military governor of Boston. And here you have the entire population of Massachusetts was convinced that what he was doing was illegitimate and that they actually were the sovereigns to the extent that they were willing to take up arms against him. All right. So something had educated them about that, and I am convinced that the school in which they learned this was fundamentally the militia school, because they were acting as self-governors in all of that organization and training that went on. Similarly, in Virginia, same time period, Lord Dunmore, John Murray, the Earl of Dunmore, last royal governor of Virginia, he tried to pull the same stunt, taking the powder out of the magazine at Williamsburg and created something of a brouhaha, if you will, at the time. And you had Patrick Henry on the other side, and Patrick Henry is off agitating and raising what they call in Virginia independent companies, because Virginia had an interesting situation. Their militia law ran out in 1773. Statute ran only to 1773, and they wanted to pass another one. And Dunmore, not only would he not sign a bill, he wouldn't show up at the sittings of the General Assembly so that nothing could be done. They couldn't even pass a bill. They couldn't even vote on the bill. All right. he didn't want any kind of militia bill or anything along that line passed. So Patrick Henry is going around organizing independent companies in the various counties. And Dunmore starts putting out proclamations telling people not to associate with Henry. Henry's a dangerous individual. He's engaged in sedition. And then the next one, he tells the people to, as the expression went, repair to the king's standard. All the people should, in the Virginia militia should join him. And then number three, he declares martial law. We were talking about martial law earlier. He declares martial law, right? Well, did Patrick Henry and the rest of those Virginians say, oh, my God, he declared martial law, we have to give up? Exactly the opposite. In fact, Dunmore, by the time he declared martial law, he was a fugitive in Chesapeake Bay on a British man of war, and he was putting out his proclamations on a stolen printing press. They drove him out of the state. All right? And that type of thing happened all up and down the coast. I just picked those two because they're such dramatic incidents. Well, the Constitution adopts these entities, what it calls the militia of the several states, these things that existed out there. So they're permanent parts of the Constitution. And in fact, they're more permanent than the Army and the Navy, because the Army and the Navy Congress doesn't have to fund. We don't have to have an Army and a Navy. The Constitution says we have to have these things called the militia of the several states. And then along comes the Second Amendment and tells us, affirms that, and tells us in emphatic terms that these are necessary to the ultimate goal of the entire Constitution, which is the preservation of a free state. So now I ask you, all right, are we living in a free state today? You know the answer to that question. No,
well,
because why?
It's...
We don't have the institutions that the Constitution tells us are necessary for that purpose.
Is there such thing as a free police state?
Well, no, obviously not, but we don't have those institutions. If X is necessary for Y and you don't have X, then you don't have Y, right? It's kind of simple-minded algebra, right? Simple-minded algebraic problem. Constitution tells us we have to have these entities. They're not there. Conclusion, we have a problem. It's fascinating, especially when you go and look at the statute that Congress has dealing with the militia. You can look this up. Title 10 of the United States Code deals with militia and powers of the organization and so forth and so on. There's a section that's called the Militia of the United States. Congress has defined this thing, the Militia of the United States. Well, you look in the Constitution until your eyes fall out. You won't find anything called the Militia of the United States. There's no such thing. Militia of the United States, according to Congress, consists of two things, the National Guard, which if you read the statutes is actually an adjunct of the Army. I'm not criticizing the National Guard, but it's not a militia. It's part of the Army. And then the other part of this Militia of the United States is the unorganized militia. Well, that's everybody else. That's you and me and a lot of other people listening on this call. We're part of this thing called the unorganized militia. You go back to the Constitution. What are the powers of Congress with respect to the militia? What's the first one? Well, to provide for calling forth the militia for certain purposes, execute the laws, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. Okay, that's what militias always did. Second one, the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. Ooh, okay. Its power is to organize the militia. Why was that there? So there'd be some kind of uniformity, so that you wouldn't have different structures in the different states, right? So the power is to organize. Well, if the power is to organize, how can Congress unorganize the militia? Follow that? Okay.
By instituting the National Guard.
Well, the National Guard is not a militia. The National Guard is an adjunct of the Army. And if you look at and they're different. If you look at the president's powers, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, president is the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. That's one of his military hats. And of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. They're different things. And there's a reason for that. Because the founding fathers knew that they were very suspicious of standing armies. Even Blackstone, the great commentator on common law, who was a monarchist to the very end, even he recognized that standing armies was something of a danger in England. Founding fathers were against standing armies for very good reasons. So they separate these two functions in the Constitution. And now what Congress has done is Congress has taken under this guise of the what they call the militia of the United States, it has created a National Guard, which is part of the Army, and it has put everybody else in this category of unorganization, which means that there's nothing going on. And if you look at the various states, you'll find the same structure. And here in Virginia, exactly the same structure, a little more complicated in the statute. You've got the National Guard, and they've got a thing called the Virginia Defense Force, which is an adjunct to the National Guard, and then there's the militia, the unorganized, that's everybody else. Well, constitutionally, you can't have an unorganized militia. Constitutionally, you can't have an unarmed militia. And how do they arm people in the pre-constitutional period? The statute said you have to go and buy a gun. And if you can't afford one, we'll get one for you. That is, gun control in those days was everyone was supposed to be armed. Gun control in these days is they're trying to disarm as many people as possible, so the only people that have arms are the police and the regular armed forces.
That's what communist regimes do.
Well, there you go. Okay, totalitarian regimes, police state regimes. That's exactly what they – if you look at every one of these indicia, every indicator – they're all not simply non-constitutional. They're anti-constitutional. It's not simply that they failed to do something they ought to do. They've done something affirmatively to attack the constitutional structure. All right, so once again, we come back to now what? Now what do we do? And the answer is, well, if you're going to be a self-governing people, you better start governing yourselves. And this is the one thing the Constitution says you absolutely have to have before everything else, because the bottom line is force. This is what you have.
Edwin,
well, we don't have that.
Edwin, we've got
four
minutes left. I'm going to let you go right until the music starts playing. We've had a question about why so much talk about the federal constitution and not focus on the state constitution. You might want to let them know that the legislations that you've been writing are for the state constitution.
Oh, they're all for the
states. And why?
Yeah, they're all for the states. But the reason I'm focusing on this is because this is the checkmate to federal intervention. The feds are not going to be able to say that you're doing something at the state solely under the state constitution, and therefore it's subject to being overridden under the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution. Because the militias of the several states, there's one in each state, 50 of them supposedly, they are constitutional entities at both levels. They're a constitutional entity at the federal level, and you'll also find them in just about every state constitution as well. They would have to be in the state constitutions because the federal constitution requires them. So that's the only reason I keep bringing up the federal constitution, because it's a checkmate on Congress. If this is done at the state level, it's constitutional in a way that Congress can't interfere with, because the Constitution requires these entities to exist. In the same way, talking about the alternative currency, I've got a Supreme Court decision that says it, that the states can have their own alternative currency and there's no way that Congress can interfere, and that's a matter of their position in the Constitution, their reserved portion of sovereignty. So the important thing is not simply to be able to do this at the state level because state law allows it. It's to be able to do it at the state level because the U.S. Constitution sanctions it as well. And then you have the firmest foundation. That's the checkmate. That's the thing that makes the Tenth Amendment approach work, is that you can take these actions, not simply talk, but you can take these actions in areas of critical control, finances, and ultimately the security question, at the state level, and have a constitutional basis for saying that the state is able to take these actions without any kind of interference from Washington, D.C. Whatever kind of fringe they have around the flag in the Capitol building. Okay? I'm not in the least worried about, under these circumstances, I'm not in the least worried about what color fringe they have.
We've got a little less than 2 minutes to go. What would you like to close out with? Is there any websites you'd like for people to check out or books that are coming up? Maybe.
Well, no, they can go to newswithviews.com. I have an archive there. Go back to 2005 and follow this through and, you know, look and see what kind of a prophet I was. I don't claim to be a, you know, gypsy fortune teller, but just take a look and see. I have a couple of books coming out. One is the reprint of my book, Pieces of Eight, which is the monetary history, what I consider to be the definitive demolition of the constitutionality or legitimacy even of any in any way of the Federal Reserve System. And then I'm just about finished writing volume two of my militia series, and this is the one that lays out in very great detail the kind of history that I was just going on the surface with you a little while ago, and leads right up to, okay, now we know how the Constitution has to be interpreted. Here's all the history. Now, what do we do with that?
And that should be out. We do have one caller. We have about 60 seconds. Caller 240, you got a quick question?
Yes, just wondering your opinion on the comparison between the police and the sheriff.
Okay, sheriffs in some states are constitutional officers. In most they're not. So really there's not too much difference between sheriffs and police in terms of their legal authority. Sheriffs don't have some kind of constitutional position. Certainly they don't have any constitutional position under the U.S. Constitution. In fact, I think what would happen if you revitalize the militia, you would have all the sheriffs and all the police as subsidiary units within the militia structure. In the same way in the colonial period, you had rangers or you had minutemen or whatever. They had these subsidiary units that were specifically trained for particular, usually higher level of training than the normal militiamen, particular kinds of service. They didn't have police forces in those days. They had sheriffs and they had constables, but they didn't have what we consider to be professional police departments or law enforcement agencies. When they had serious problems, they called out the militia people. And I think that's exactly what should be done today, at least in the sense that the units that we have out there, sheriff's departments, various law enforcement, emergency services people, would all become subsets of the militia. They'd still have distinctive uniforms. They'd still have their, you know, pay and so forth and so on. But they'd be units of the militia. And the reason I would push for that is that's the ultimate way to keep them disciplined. You don't want those kinds of units, those law enforcement units, to think of themselves, let alone to be, separate and independent from control by the people. And if they become members of the militia, those units, then they're going to be subject to militia discipline and control. They're not going to have any kind of independence. And that will end every kind of police brutality, oppression, whatever. That will disappear under those circumstances.
We are out of time. And Edwin, I thank you so much for coming on tonight. This has been a great show.
Thank you.
And that 2 hours went fast. We didn't even take a break. And I'll be in touch with you later. And just have a great night. And you're wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Right. We'll see everybody next week. Thank you very much. Red, good night.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I'd thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to Santa Fe, from Detroit down to Houston and New York to L.A., well, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and face. American, where is least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
I walked through a county courthouse square. On a park bench, an old man was sitting there. I said, "Your old courthouse is kind of run down." He said, "No, it'll do for our little town." I said, "Your old flagpole has leaned a little bit, and that's a ragged old flag you got hanging on it." He said, "Have a seat." And I sat down. "Is this the first time you've been to our little town?" I said, "I think it is." He said, "I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag. You see, we got a little hole in that flag there when Washington took it across the Delaware. And it got powder burned the night that Francis Scott Key sat watching it write and say, 'Can you see?' And it got a bad rip in New Orleans with Pakenham and Jackson tugging at its seams. And it almost fell at the Alamo beside the Texas flag, but she waved on, though. She got cut with a sword at Chancellorsville, and she got cut again at Shiloh Hill. There was Robert E. Lee, Beauregard, and Bragg, and the south wind blew hard on that ragged old flag. On Flanders Field in World War I, she got a big hole from a Bertha gun. She turned blood red in World War II. She hung limp and low a time or two. She was in Korea, Vietnam. She went where she was sent by her Uncle Sam. She waved from our ships upon the briny foam, and now they've about quit waving back here at home. In her own good land here, she's been abused. She's been burned, dishonored, denied, and refused. And the government for which she stands is scandalized throughout the land. And she's getting threadbare, and she's wearing thin, but she's in good shape for the shape she's in. She's been through the fire before, and I believe she can take a whole lot more. So we raise her up every morning, we take her down every night, we don't let her touch the ground, and we fold her upright. On second thought, I do like to brag, 'cause I'm mighty proud of that ragged old flag.
I was there in the winter of 64 when we camped in the ice at Nashville's door. 300 miles our trail had led, barely had time to bury our dead. When the Yankees charged and the colors fell, Overton Hill was a living hell. When we called retreat, it was almost dark. I died with a grape shot in my heart. Say a prayer for peace, for every fallen son. Set my spirit free, let me lay down my gun. Sweet Mother Mary, I'm so tired, but I can't come home till the last shot's fired. In June of 1944, I waited in the blood of Omaha's shore. 21 and scared to death, my heart pounding in my chest. I almost made the first seawall when my friends turned and saw me fall. I still smell the smoke, I can taste the mud as I lay there dying from a loss of blood.
Fight for the right and to build a nation. Fight when the army goes rolling along. While the bow Washington.